The numbers right now, wind from the northwest at 14, gusting to 24. 70% humidity, 72 degrees Kenosha, now 71 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very excited indeed about today's morning show, as I am welcoming back into our studios a talented artist illustrator by the name of Ed Steckley, born and raised in Racine, and who recently came back to town. And I made acquaintance with Ed when he auditioned for and ultimately was cast in the Racine Theatre Guild's production of the hit musical Mamma Mia, playing one of the three dads.
That was me.
That was you. And then somewhere in our conversations, people in the cast, several of them mentioned his talents and that how it would be great for me to talk to him on my morning show. And then come to realize that Ed, back in 2015, had been a guest of the Kenosha Festival of Cartooning, that wonderful event, that brilliant brainchild of John and Ann Morse Hambrock. And so he actually was on the morning show back in 2015. But that was, of course, one of those crazy days with six talented people crowded around the table. Great, great fun. So I am realizing now that it's the second visit now to the morning show for Ed Steckley, who, as I think I implied in the introduction earlier, returned to his hometown of Racine earlier this year, but is continuing his award-winning work as an illustrator. So we're going to be talking today on the morning show about his life, how all of this got started, about the work that he's done with Mad Magazine, with various advertising accounts, the trips that he has taken as part of USO tours, visiting military bases and hospitals all around the world, the books that he has created as well. Lots and lots to talk about. And Ed Steckley, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Wow, Greg, you make me sound like a professional.
Well, it's great to have you back, and I'm glad we can have a conversation about all of this and more. So one of the things you said, I re-listened to our conversation from back in 2015.
And, my apologies.
And when I asked everybody to kind of their origin stories in terms of how they got started as illustrators, you said something to the effect that you weren't smart enough to do anything else except draw. I suspect that's not literally true.
I believe you 100% that I said that.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about, the circumstances under which you started to draw, and what kind of initially drew you to it.
I started to draw when I was probably 6 or 7 months, I like to say. When I'm asked this, I always put my hand about 2 feet from the ground and say I was about that big.
Hmm.
The thing is about drawings that every little kid draws. You give a little kid a box of crayons and they're going to color and they're going to, you know, be creative. I was one of the ones that never stopped doing that. I would also, you know, try to dissuade my classmates from doing the same thing because I didn't want any competition. So I was just, it was one of those things, it was just, it was never really a choice. I was always drawing, and other than, you know, a quick, sidetrack in college, it was just what I was going to do. I didn't know how, I didn't know why, I didn't ask the questions. That's the part where I wasn't smart enough to think it through. I just knew I was going to do it, and I had a very supportive family who, you know, every Christmas I would get sketchbooks and all this and that. And I had a cousin, my stepdad's nephew, was a bigwig at Marvel Comics. His name is Mark Grunewald. Comic book people will know that name. He also encouraged me because Mark was an editor at Marvel. He edited everything at Marvel, Captain America, all those great comic books. And I would talk to Mark, and he would also draw, but he opted to go into editing. But he would sit and draw whatever characters we'd want to draw at Christmas time and holidays and stuff. And all of us would, you know, inevitably says, "Draw me Superman." He'd probably roll his eyes and go, "It's another company," but whatever.
Yeah, right.
So I got to watch an artist draw, which, I mean, that I was sold. And then right around fourth or fifth grade, I saw my first issue of Mad Magazine, and that was that. I just looked at it and I pored over it, and I didn't even think I read anything in that magazine for 3 years. I would just look at the artwork and go, this was drawn by a person somewhere. I want to meet this person, A. But I would look at it and just go, "Oh, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen." It was my little secret. Because in my mind, if anybody else saw this, they would look at it and go, "I want to do that too." So I kind of held that one close to the vest. But when I was in middle school at McKinley Middle School in Racine, I started working for the school paper and drawing teachers and getting kind of in trouble for it, I like to say, although I never really did. A teacher's always supportive of a kid who draws. And that was it. That started the path. And I'm still waiting to become a professional.
So you were indeed serious about this. You ultimately graduate from Park High School, and again, even through high school, this was what we would identify you as.
Absolutely.
I mean, not for music or not for sports or
anything else. For my looks, nothing.
Okay.
No, I did. I worked at the Park Beacon, the newspaper there, and I did cartoons, and that's when I started to really kind of think about writing and doing comic strips. So I loved caricature, and to me that was like the end, that was the end all be all, and that was the joke. But then I realized you could do caricatures, but you had to kind of incorporate them into something if you wanted to work for things like Mad. And I did a lot of work for the Park Beacon, and every now and then some of those will just show up on Facebook, and I'll look at them, and I go, "Oh, geez, that was terrible. They're very dated."
Wow.
You know?
So would those be, were you creating, like, comic strips about Park High School, or were they more kind of about the whole world?
They were about whatever was on my mind. I put things off to the last minute, which I still do. I work with the deadline gun to my head all the time. It's just how I'm wired. So I would, whatever was popular at the day. In fact, when Desert Storm happened, I did I created a little Saddam Hussein character, and they were dreadfully unfunny and painful. But whatever was popular at the time, Arsenio Hall was on. And so I did a lot of gags with him. I should have said, or before all this, I'm a terrible writer. I'm just not a writer. So I would just kind of do whatever I wanted to do using whatever tools I had. And, they had a space to fill, so they put it in.
So you go off to the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater for college, studying art, I assume.
Yep.
And one of the stories you told back in 2015, which was really hilarious, is how you became involved in what I think was not the official school paper at UW-Whitewater, but some kind of alternative newspaper.
Yep. Started up, I didn't start it up, but some people didn't like the slant of the regular paper, not to talk politics, but because I don't know anything about that. We started up a little alternative newspaper with a staff of five people, and it was an ad I read somewhere come out and be in our, you know, help us put this thing together. So I said, I'm going to go be a cartoonist. So I did. I came out and I drew pictures for it. And what that meant was we would get to go to see concerts for free, because you call up a concert, whatever, and say, we're with the school paper, and they'd get you backstage and get to meet everybody. So I'd go to these concerts. I would bring a sketchbook, and I would draw the band. And that's pretty much the extent of what I did, because I'm not a political cartoonist at all. Honestly, some of those show up less frequently than the Park Beacon ones do. I have no idea if they were any good. I'm kind of guessing no. But either way, you know, I was happy to be doing it. I remember, like, sitting in my dorm room saying, oh, I have to get this drawing out. And that's when I started to kind of feel like somewhat of a professional, like, oh, I have to do this now, not just I want to do this. So that's where the discipline kind of started. And that started my road down. See, I don't consider myself an artist first. That's what I do. I consider myself a businessman, I guess you could say. Like, that's first, because, you know, you have to get good at accounting and time management and all this. And that's why any success I've had, I think I can trace back to that more than talent. No one likes to really admit that. You want to think that, oh, I'm so good, how could someone turn me down? But actually, it's, you know, can you talk to people? Can you network? Do you know how to do a portfolio and do all this and that? And I think that started actually maybe in high school with the paper, but also in college when I just had a deadline. And that's when things really started to click.
Right. I guess it's when you start to realize that this thing I'm creating is not just because it's fun for me, but it's because there's this blank space on the page and they are depending on it. And you need to be able to deliver, and I suppose you need to learn how to collaborate with editors and others whom you are serving in a sense. So
exactly right. I had no idea what art direction was. But I was happy to get it because, you know, editor can look at some drawing and go, well, this would be better if you did this, or this would be better if you did this. And I was kind of a punk, but I always, you know, wanted to make the artwork better. So I don't think I ever had a chip on my shoulder about, this is my way, this is how I do things. That also led, that's any success I have also goes back to being able to do that, to collaborate.
We're speaking with award-winning illustrator Ed Steckley, a Racine native who is actually now back here in southeastern Wisconsin after decades in more exotic locales, but a very, very, very busy career as an illustrator. So you were telling me before we went on the air that you actually did not finish out at Whitewater, at least back then. You were, in a sense, called away because you started getting work.
Yeah.
So, I mean, although you want to be self-deprecating about the quality of what you were doing there, somebody apparently noticed. I mean, tell us how you started to get professional gigs and how that led you away from Whitewater.
That's a tough one. I was, me and a good pal of mine would open up retail caricature stands in theme parks around the country. And I did that for years. Worked at Great America for a bit in Chicago, but me and my good pal Tom Richmond, who does the movie parodies in Mad Magazine, we opened up these operations all around the country. So I would work, draw out in the trenches, I'd like to say, in the theme parks for 3 months out of the year, and then that would build up my career in the off season. And I did a lot of time marketing and all that. So I would, I think my senior year of college, we opened up a shop in St. Louis and went down there and worked all summer. And then I started to get some comic book work. I worked for a comic book company called Slave Labor Graphics out of San Jose. And that was the bottom of the barrel of comic books. But I just made a decision that, you know what, I had gotten all I was going to get out of college, because I had taken all the classes. I had taken anatomy and all. What I had to do left was, I don't know, art history or something. And I just, you know, didn't go back. And that always kind of hung over my head. I was a semester or so short. I took some classes when I was in St. Louis, but not enough to finish. And always kind of hung over my head, like all my family, they all have degrees, going back to grandma. And I said, oh, I'll just do this now. I had some free time. Some books came out, and I was ready to kind of take a break. So I went back. I contacted Whitewater, who I do work with. I do talks and symposiums at the art school at Whitewater. And I just worked it out where I could do an independent study and finish my degree. And the story I like to tell is there's a graveyard in Kenosha that's a little bit quieter because Grandma stopped rolling around in it, because now all of the grandkids have their, or all the grandkids who are that age have their college degrees. So I've got it. I don't know where it is. It's somewhere around, but in a place of honor, I think.
I want to ask you a little bit about that work that you did in those summers, and actually for many, many years, that live caricature drawing in theme parks. And, of course, I think probably most of our listeners know what you're talking about, but obviously for those that don't, it's when you go to one of these stands and you sit there and some artist draws a caricature of you that looks kind of like you, but in sort of cartoonish fashion. What is involved in doing that? I mean, when you are, and I realize you probably haven't done that in quite some time, but when somebody sits down in front of you, a client as you were, as it is, what is it that you're doing in terms of looking at them and fashioning a caricature of them? What's actually involved in that process?
That's a great question, because I like to think that, well, I like to think, I can actually say with certainty that caricature is more psychological than physical drawing. You can take a pen or a marker, we would use big thick pencils, you can draw something, but you have to reach into the back of your head, and when someone looks at another person, unconsciously we all create this snapshot. It's a first impression. So you can look at someone and then look away, and later on you can look back and kind of remember that person because of this unconscious snapshot that you have in your head. But what a good caricaturist does, and there's, you know, this is, I could talk about, you know, that business, but what a good caricaturist does is able to reach into that unconscious and bring this snapshot forward and realize what stands out, what makes this person different from the next person. Faces only vary in millimeters. If an alien came down from the sky and looked at two different people, we would look the same, no matter who we were, because, you know, eyes vary in millimeters. Noses are basically here. Mouths are only, they only do this. They don't do that, you know. What we would do is really get into the psychology of it and figure and try to deconstruct that person's face. And a lot of that, one of the tricks is, you know, if someone sits in front of you, what you squint. You squint your eyes, you make a dumb face, you squint your eyes until you can barely see anymore. And what's left is what's important about that person. And then you emphasize those. There's a lot of misconception about good caricature. A lot of people think, oh, it's mean, or it's just going to make my nose big. What you do is you're celebrating that person's face, and you can bring to the table whatever you like. A mentor of mine out in New York would say that you can bring to the table, you can look through lenses that are, let's see, what's a better way to put this? You can bring love to the table. You can draw someone and you know, where your head's at, it can be more of a celebration. Or some people like to draw where they go for the jugular and make things mean. I was never that guy. I was always a nice caricature guy. But we took a lot of pride in our work. A lot of us, all of us, had copies of Mad close by, because that's where the caricatures were. And who we hired were people that were very serious about doing art. So a lot of people from, especially, it kind of ended in the 90s when the business model changed for theme parks. But we had a lot of people go off to do comic books. The monsters and Stranger Things are designed by a caricature artist who we worked with in St. Louis. So it was, you know, we hired artists who took it very seriously. A few of us went off to do Mad, as an example. Actually, I started in Cracked magazine.
I remember
Cracked. A lot of people who went to work for Cracked did it because they wanted to get into Mad, and Mad at least looked at Cracked. There's always a cheap knockoff,
right?
But you know that. But so the theme park stuff absolutely translated into the real world. And it also, when you're sitting there drawing for 12 hours a day and you've got people behind you watching you, commenting, judging, you get a thick skin. And I got that. That helped me immensely, especially working in advertising in New York. You got to work with a, or what I had to do was I'd have to sit in a round table full of art directors and creative directors and muckety mucks and everybody and sit and draw live while they're looking over your shoulder, you know, making comments. That absolutely doesn't bother me at all. So I can draw whatever, wherever. I don't care who's around. It doesn't matter. I know a lot of artists, I have to be alone. It was never that. It's just, you know, we do work alone a lot. It's a very solitary life, but I never had a problem with drawing live. That said, there's a lot of people in New York especially who like to bring sketchbooks onto the subway. It just sketch people who were there, and I was never that guy. Because then you draw attention to yourself, and I don't want that. But, yeah, I could talk about the correlation between drawing live in the theme parks to how that translates to the real world. If you know, I could go on and on about that. So you need to stop me.
I'm just going to stop you to reintroduce you. My guest today on the morning show is illustrator Ed Steckley, a Racine native who is back now in southeastern Wisconsin. What we're talking about is his long career as an award-winning illustrator. And you did that summertime theme park caricature drawing for quite a few years, but ultimately, you know, kind of wore out after a while and entered other professional realms, including, as you've already touched on, Mad Magazine. Tell us about your first paid gig with Mad Magazine, which had to be a thrill. I mean, you as someone who had enjoyed Mad Magazine from early childhood, I mean, how did that first come about that you were able to actually draw for Mad Magazine?
One of the reason I got into Mad was had the same origins as any other job I've gotten. If you've seen anything that I've done that you think might be cool, and I'm not talking about you, Greg. I know you don't think any of it's cool. But like books or magazines or advertising, everything can be traced back to meeting the right person at some organization. I've always been a member of the National Caricaturist Network, the NC, and now it's the International Society of Caricature Artists. I was on the board and helped run that for a couple of years, and now I'm the vice president of the National Cartoonist Society. And at these conventions and forums or whatever, you just kind of meet people. So it's Mad. I met the art director at Mad in 2001 or something like that. Sam Viviano, who's now a good friend of mine, but we met and I showed him my work, and because the timing was right, because we were at some artsy function, and Sam kind of, he worked with me a bit, gave me a lot of advice. Nick Meglin is another one who was helped kind of steer me as well. People who know EC Comics and Mad Magazine know who Nick Meglin is. And then I got the call, I think in 2004, for a really small bad job. It was a Russell Crowe caricature. And I did such a fantastic job on that I didn't get a call for another 12 years from Mad. I hold the world record for longest time between articles at Mad Magazine. For whatever reason, I don't think I was quite ready for it yet, but they started to call again in the 15 or 16 or so. And I've been a regular since then because I had just gotten to a level, I guess professionally, where I could at least make it look like I could hold a candle to everybody else who was in Mad. So, yeah, that's how that started. I'm sure it was 2004, and then a hiatus, not of my doing, until, you know, it was probably 10 years, actually, later on. So, and I've been in there ever since, and I did the cover of Mad earlier this year. So that was always movie parodies and covers, and I know I was next in line for a cover when they announced that they weren't going to do movie parodies anymore, which is a real drag. There's a lot of shakeups in the corporate world. DC Comics, which is owned by AT&T, now Discovery, you know, the Bean Counters are in charge, we're not going to put as much money into this, blah, 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 blah. But either way, it's still a thrill. When a Mad job comes in, I clear the schedule and, you know, let it go. I turn everything else off. And I'm happy to work for my lowest paying client of all time.
There you go. You have also, of course, done lots of work in the realm of advertising. You already touched on what it's like to be in a room with the so-called blue suits who are literally sometimes looking over your shoulder as you are drawing out different ideas for them. So just explain what a typical gig in that realm is like. I mean,
in advertising?
I mean that when you get the call that such and such a company needs X from you, typically, what does that kind of look like? Oh, I don't mean literally what does it look like on the page,
but you don't want to
What is that process like? I mean, what are they typically asking for, and what is the process by which you try to serve what they desire?
You and your good questions. I would say with advertising, it can go in a lot of different directions, but I think generally how it'll work is I'll get a script. They say, here's the TV commercial that we want to produce, or a print campaign. And I do a lot of pharma, which is, you know, the boring stuff. But I also do, consumer good. I drew the Charmin bears for years.
Uh-huh.
And I would get a script, and I would be on the phone or in the agency in New York and say, okay, we're going to have 9 frames, and we're going to have their keyframes, if anybody knows animation. We're going to have this frame is going to have this happening, and this frame is going to have this happening, and this, we're not sure about this one, if you have any ideas on this one. And then I'll go sketch these things up quickly. Everything has to be done yesterday. Classic advertising. And I would do sketches. In the old days, I'd do them on paper, scan them in, and only I faxed a few. That's how old I am. But now you just draw it on the computer. I've got this really cool magic tablet. It's 24 inches wide. It's a huge drawing screen. It's like a glorified iPad. And that's connected to a Macintosh, whatever the Macs are called now. And just draw it on there, save it, zip it off, off it goes, and get feedback. And either they'll make changes or they'll say go to color. And that's that. That would be like for one TV commercial. That would be about 3 days worth of work. Other times, it'll be what's called an ideation session, which is the new buzzword I'm trying to really have catch on here. That's when you're given 50 ideas, and you do a drawing for each one. And then those are put up on a wall, and that's the very beginning of, probably the second step of any ad campaign. So a bunch of writers, copywriters will sit around and they'll come up with their ideas. And then when they narrow it down to whatever number, they'll give those to me and I'll flesh them out a bit. And then those will get another round of, pass or fails. And that's whittled down to however many different ideas they want to show the client. It's a very Mad Men, actually, which is kind of fun. Yeah, I loved watching that show because there was the illustrator on the show, and I'd watch him and go, I know what he's going through. Although, in the old days, like when I started in Mad Men and what's the Guillermo del Toro movie about the fish dude? That movie has a side story about this advertising illustrator. And I kept watching it going, I want to learn more about that guy. Because you do a big painting, and on Mad Men and in real life, you can do a final painting or something really nifty to show. And someone will say, that needs to be red, or that needs to be a woman. And they'll just hand it back to you and go, okay, make it happen. And we need it immediately. That kind of thing happens. So it's a lot of working under pressure. A lot of it is very dry, but there is some funny stuff. I'm always good at being open to, not getting into my own head about artwork. So I've drawn stuff that's funny. I've drawn stuff that's very not funny. If it's the worst ad campaign of all time, all I do is just think about the invoice I'm going to send off at the end, and that makes everything better. But the more I'm in the business, the more people tend to kind of know what I'm good at. So I get a lot more funny stuff now with animated stuff and characters. Like I said, I drew the Charmin bears for years. There's a couple mascots that I worked on that I can't even say because there's NDAs signed about this, But it's every job is different. Like, no job is the same. If I'm starting a job on Monday, and they'll have me booked Monday through Friday, I will have no idea what I'm going to be doing. Hmm. Sometimes it's figure drawings of people walking on the beach holding hands. Other times it's a new character for, you know, some snot medicine or something like that. And great, either way, I'm happy to be doing it. Hmm. There's never going to be a point where I kind of put my head down and go, how am I going to do this? Because it's my job. Hmm. I have to do it. I can't sit and stress over it. You know, it's easier said than done. But I don't sit and agonize over, how am I going to draw this drawing? If I have to draw a close-up of a hand and I'm not really drawing good that day, I always have a mirror right next to my drawing board where I can look at my hand and, you know, draw it, you know.
So you find a way, one way
yep,
or another.
Absolutely.
Do you prefer gigs where your client has very specific and maybe multiple or numerous ideas about exactly what they want?
Absolutely.
Or do you prefer a gig where they just want something great and they want you to come up with that? maybe it doesn't happen in that way all that often.
That would apply to the books I do in particular. But for like what you said, I'd much rather be first of all, the way I approach things is, you know, the client doesn't work for me. I work for the client. I want the whatever team is on this, I want them to especially the art directors who do the writing. I want them to be able to say, we're looking for this. Draw something out. Do a thumbnail sketch on a piece of paper. It's crude with stick figures. Here's what we're looking for. Hmm. Can you make this look good? I love that. Hmm. Because if it's left to my creativity, I'm going to be wrong sometimes. Most of the time, whatever percentage. And then that annoys the client. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm working for them. This is not about my artwork. This is about me doing a job. Mm. And I think a lot of young artists don't really have that. It's not really ingrained in you. I don't know how I ever learned it. I think I was just out of desperation wanting to make a living. And I got good advice by mentors. You're there for a reason. If you want to do your creative stuff on the side, great. Or if you want to go do artwork for galleries, great. But if you're working in advertising, you have to be a part of a team, and you have to be able to take criticism, to be able to make changes. And a term I like to use is not get married to the drawing, because it's going to be thrown out. The very famous illustrator at Mad Magazine named Jack Davis. Jack is one of the greats. He did. He was one of the top illustrators in the world. Time Magazine covers, record covers, everything. Jack was always working, and Jack, art directors loved to work for Jack because Jack would do an entire drawing, an entire painting, and submit it, and the art director would go, no, we weren't really looking for that. We were looking for more of X, Y, or Z. And Jack, the southern gentleman, oh, you bet. He'd take that drawing and wrap, you know, put it in the trash can and redo another one and still be done at 5 o'clock so we can go golf. That's the mentality that I got. And that's from doing research and then talking to a lot of Mad Magazine artists who were old school guys. I now have that. It's just, you know, this isn't for me. I like doing it, but in the end, this is for a job. Okay. And everything is kind of like that. Children's books too. I mean, it still has to impress the publisher, and it still has to sell. And there's people who know more about selling books than I do. Hmm. You know, I take pride in my work. And luckily, the older I get, the more leeway I am kind of given on jobs. People kind of know who I am. They know what I do. So that's pretty cool. But, you know, the jobs are going to come in where, someone needs to say, this person's going to be holding a different type of phone. Can you redo it? Luckily now with computers, you can just kind of, you know, put on the delete or the erase tool and erase that. But for other, you know, well, oh man, I can go on and on, and I will.
It's a fascinating life, and you know, most of us don't know the first thing about it. So
good.
That's why we're having this conversation. You mentioned illustrating for children's books, and I've always find that to be kind of a fascinating matter in and of itself. When it comes to that specific assignment of creating illustrations for a children's book where you know that it is going to be at least primarily children who are going to be reading that book or really taking it in, mm-hmm. when that is your audience, what kind of things do you think about as an illustrator that would lead you to create things differently from something that's really intended for adults?
Another good question. You're on a roll. I'm a little worried about you. Children's books, my mentality, I go into it coming from a family of teachers. Hmm. So I always look at things from that point of view. Like, would this fly? I talked to my sister's a principal in St. Louis. My mom's a retired teacher at Racine Unified. I always kind of look at it through their eyes, like, would this fly? Like, if there's a gag in there, A, would kids get it? Because I do a lot of background gags. Would kids get it? Do they even do this now? Because I don't have kids. In fact, in the latest, I do a series of Rube Goldberg books. If anybody knows Rube Goldberg, there's a picture book series and there's a middle reader series. In the last picture book that came out this spring, I had to draw a playground. One of his Rube's machines is utilizing a playground. Hmm. And I know what I think a playground looks like because, you know, I grew up in the 70s. Hmm. I had to call my sister and I just said, I got a feeling they don't have these death traps anymore on the playground. She said, you're absolutely right. She sent a picture of her school's playground and a lot of plastic, a lot of very safe things. And so, yeah, I would have gotten that completely wrong.
Wow.
But my goal is you want the kids to look at a book and that you want to give them a reason to go back to the book. So all of my picture books have something at the end that references the beginning of the book. So they can go find in the newest book, the last two-page spread is a bunch of animals. Just sees Rube is surrounded by animals. It's a pretty cool painting, if I do say so myself. But then you can go back in the book and you can find each of these animals in the book. Where was that alligator? Oh, he was over here. A lot of that. My goal is twofold. One, to get to increase the rereadability of the book, but also you want the parents who are buying the book, you want them to pick it up and go, oh, either the artwork is really good or there has some reason to it. The Rube books, they have A, B, C, and D, parts of the machine. A leads to B, leads to C, da-da-da. So if it's a little kid, they can learn their alphabet. Find the A, find the B. And as kids get older, they can read the funny text that goes along with it and learn what the name of this goofy bird is, you know, who's going to be flying away with the bag of almonds that was laid out, and that's going to trip some other part of the machine. So I have a lot of things in mind, but actually the very first thing I do is I amuse myself. I have to, especially with the books, you can't phone that in. You got to be in the mindset to do it. With the chapter books, that was a very different animal because it was these same characters, but now they're older, and it's more about their story. And frankly, it's more about the writing. I just do the drawings that help illustrate what's going on and give the eye a break, you know. So it's a bunch of black and white. The first book had 80-some drawings in it, but that's how you really get to meet the characters in the book, and I really love doing that. When you read a book, you get a picture of what these characters look like, but then I'm the one who gets to say, well, this is what Pearl looks like, this is what Rube looks like, this is what everybody else looks like, and ideally they're going to fit what the reader had in mind, because I read the story just like everybody else, and as I'm reading it, I get an image in my head of what this character is going to look like, what she's going to look like. And then I work on those. And that part I really got a kick out of. That's fun.
And so we're talking about this series. I think it's three books inspired by the work of Rube Goldberg. And I think your most recent, Rube Goldberg, Simple, Normal, Definitely Different Day Off.
Yeah.
And that's a takeoff on an earlier book, Rube Goldberg's Simple, Normal, Humdrum School Day.
Yes.
And
congratulations on getting those right.
Right. So we are starting to run out of time, but I want to give you a couple minutes to talk about something that I think has been really gratifying work for you that you began, I think, back in 2009. Traveling the world with some of your fellow cartoonists and illustrators to military bases and hospitals as part of the good work of the USO. Summarize for us how meaningful that's been for you.
I could go on and on about this. You're going to have to add another hour.
But sure
back in 1945, a bunch of cartoonists who had been going overseas to World War II to entertain. This is back when cartoonists were celebrities. Hmm. When you think about the USO, you think of, you know, Marilyn Monroe and doing all that. Well, the cartoonists were the same. It would be Milton Caniff, all these big-time cartoonists. They would do these trips, and when the war ended, they all lived in New York, so they just formed a little club where they got together and, you know, did a lot of drawing and drinking and doing some outreach programs. That became the National Cartoonist Society. And all through the Cartoonist Society's history, up until the end of Vietnam, there would always be these trips in conjunction with the USO, where a small group would just go overseas, wherever the USO or the military thought there needed to be some morale raising. And then that start back in 2008 or so, they started up again. Mm-hmm. Why don't we do these trips? Someone said at a business meeting. And so sure enough, the USO started planning these tours with a group, 8 to 12 cartoonists to go overseas wherever and set up and just draw for people and draw, they would draw, if they have a comic strip, they could draw the comic strip for what people. I would do caricatures. I'd be the Mad Magazine guy who could draw, people live or hold up a phone and I could draw the kids, that kind of thing. It's also more talking. It's more talking than anything. Because when you go to like remote Afghanistan or, the places, northeastern Africa, it's a little taste of home. Hmm. So, what's going on back in Chicago? A lot of that. And it really, doing that for the, I've been on a number of the, I couldn't even tell you how many, but I've been doing them since 2010 or 2011, I've been doing trips. And it really changed my life, because if I ever worried about, where's my next paycheck going to come from, or, worrying, if I ever worried about anything, that got really put into perspective when I saw how people that are putting their lives on the line in war zones or in hospitals. We do a lot at hospitals. My life is really pretty good. I was never in the military. I would have been terrible at it. Getting up early is just not my thing. By the way, I want to thank you for this. but it really changed my life. I've been to remote parts of the world where you see how people live in third world countries, and they're still smiling and they're still happy to see you, because we don't just draw. Sometimes we get to draw locals who are working with the military, and you go, wow, I've seen joy in people's faces, but I see how the city is demolished, but they still can find joy in a cartoon. And that put everything in perspective for me. My life literally changed when I started doing that. Started worrying a lot less, and that brings me to Racine.
Well, it's really great that modern technology allows you to continue your career, but relocating back here to Racine to be closer to family for a number of different reasons. And that, of course, also coming back here to southeastern Wisconsin led you to kind of take a plunge and become a part of the Racine Theater Guild's production of Mamma Mia. Audition and to earn a slot in the cast as one of the three dads.
That was me?
Yeah, in that lighthearted musical. Had you ever been on stage before?
Well, I did a little bit of that in college. I just kind of would dabble in the theater and group. I like to sing and all that. But never like that. Although there could be a correlation made between, being an illustrator, having to do drawings in front of people, and, not be sheepish about it. Also, the live drawing, I absolutely think that helped give me a thick skin. So to answer your question, no, I guess, but I could find reasons, I could find examples of what prepared me for it. Other than, karaoke, I don't know if everybody knows this. Me and Greg do karaoke twice a week.
Right.
At his house.
So you're glad you took the plunge and did that.
That was great. That came out of nowhere. I had just moved here, and I have a good friend, Ryan Simonson, who does a lot with the Theater Guild. I was kind of a little bit mopey because I had this new condo with nothing in it, and it was winter. He said, why don't you try out audition for this thing? He'd been doing it for, he started in his 40s, I don't know. I said, no, I don't want to do that, I'm busy. And then I just decided, I will do that. And I had no idea, so I just dove in, just took a leap of faith. I don't think I would have been able to do it if I was 30, because I would have been too in my own head. But now I can just absolutely do something for the joy of doing it.
Yeah, just
That's not a career. I'm not going to get rich doing this, although I am waiting for those checks to come in. It's just fun. I just love doing it. And the show and the Theater Guild is just fantastic. Anybody who saw Mamma Mia, I mean, the cast, present company excluded, the cast was just amazing. And these are people doing community theater. And I've never seen talent like that gathered in one place or that I got to interact with. So that was really cool. Don't let that go to your head, Greg.
Well, it was great to have you, and you were wonderful in your role and fit in so beautifully, and a lot of fun. Yeah, part of a really talented and fun-loving collaborative cast that was just a pleasure to work with. So you're back here in southeastern Wisconsin, but your work goes on, and I know that
knock on wood,
if people want to see some of what you've done, they can go to your website. And I got to say, your website is one of the most colorful and fun websites I've seen in a long, long time. So explain to our listeners, if they go to your website, edsteckley.com, what they'll find there.
Oh, they're going to find a lot of, I'm trying to think of something funny, but it's too late for that. That's a lot of artwork, but I also have links to like my Instagram and, I have a YouTube page. I did a lot of YouTubes during quarantine.
Yeah.
And, by the way, I want to talk about quarantine for a bit, if you don't mind. I got a great one because I started the book that came out in spring. I started that early 2020, and I finished it in summertime. And when I came up for air at the end of the book, everybody was self-quarantining. I've been doing this for years. It didn't affect me one bit.
Right. But anyway, the same. Yeah.
Yeah. All the links to like my Instagram, the Facebook page, it's all Ed Steckley Illustrator. I just started up an Instagram called EdSteckley_advertising because I, want to let people know that I'm still around, let the advertisers know. But on the website, it's just a bunch of fun stuff. There's a blog in there, news. I have a little store where I sell books. You can sign them and all that. And it's just kind of a little fun thing that I just kind of add to now and then. But it's also Facebook at Ed Steckley Illustrator and Instagram Ed Steckley Illustrator. I'm so bad at pushing socials. I'm really glad you brought that up because I never think of that stuff. I'm really bad at it.
Yeah, we are of a certain generation, I think. We're still trying to figure all this out. Well, your website, I mean it, is an absolute delight, and it really gives us a sense of who you are and kind of the dimensions and facets of your talent.
That website was designed by a good friend of mine who owns a company in Milwaukee, oddly enough, called Byte Studios. They do stuff like my website. And if he gets any bites from this, he's going to take me out to lunch.
Well, whoever is responsible, it's a really great website, and I encourage people to seek it out. Again, it's edsteckley.com. Steckley is STECKLEY.
Yep, and the first name is really easy to spell. Yeah. That's why I picked it.
Right, edsteckley.com. Well, Ed Steckley, it has been a real delight to learn a little bit more about you, your life, your career, and all of the things that have kept you busy over the years. And I for one, am glad you're back here in southeastern Wisconsin, that you could be part of Mamma Mia, and that you could be part of the morning show today. It's been really a pleasure to reconnect, and wish you the very, very best with all that's coming forward.
This is a treat. Thanks for having me out. I really appreciate this. This is a lot of fun. You gave me a lot to think about. I don't think about stuff I've done in the past. I think about what I want to do. But this is a lot of fun.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was great to talk to you.
We can do this every day, right?
Not quite every day, but we'll do it again sometime. Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm going to welcome back to our studios Dr. Thomas Carr. the head of the paleontology department at Carthage College. And actually with him is going to be an artist. So we carry the theme a little bit.
There's more?
Yeah. So an oil painter, his name is escaping me, but who has been part of some of the field expeditions that Dr. Carr has taken over the years. And so we're going to find out about what's coming up with their latest expedition out west and about the work that this artist has done coming along on these paleontology field exhibits out to Montana. So that's tomorrow on the morning show. Thursday, Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. She'll have with her an expert in edible native plants. And then on Friday, a preview of the next Theater Guild production, which is of Stephen Sondheim.